All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I am still in New York City, Midtown. Not the greatest part of the city, really. A lot of stuff here, but it's odd that when I lived in this city, I don't know that I spent any time here almost ever. Occasionally, go to the park. Occasionally go to the Carnegie Deli, which is now just an empty awning around the corner. And I'm just struggling with a certain amount of isolation. It's an odd thing. I guess I can talk about that in a minute. It's been a pretty gnarly week last week, a pretty fucking horrendous week last week, with no real relief in sight, with a completely morally bankrupt president who does not know how to address nor care to address, and I think might even not so secretly support the actions that took place last week. Horrible. Attempted bombings, executions of African Americans, a massacre of Jews in our country. And I know that this stuff has been talked about a lot, but it's hard if you're a decent person with at least a small, even just a fragment of a moral compass and a conscience and some capacity for empathy and some capacity for seeing how this affects people and feeling horrible for what's happening. It's hard to not be living in it with a certain amount of heartbreak and horror and fear. And how do you sort of manage that? What do you do as everything just gets plowed under and sort of a tsunami of information and mind fuckedness? But I think the saddest part and the most horrible part, outside of the deaths themselves and the terrorism, is that wondering just how many people in this country think what's happened is tremendous, whatever the case was with that lunatic who sent those bombs. How many people in this country think this is tremendous? This is the country going in the right direction. How many people in this country, when they see African Americans executed, think this is terrific? This is exactly the direction we should be going. How many people in the country, when they see a slaughter of Jews at a bris, at a synagogue, think like, this is it? This is the turning. Finally, this country is heading in the right direction. How many of those are there out there? I think about it a lot. It's horrifying. And I don't mean to start the Monday off in a dark way, but I have to address it. And I was in New York City here working on the Joker movie the day that the bomb was found at Robert De Niro's restaurant, Robert De Niro's building. That was the day we were doing our scene together. So I'm heading into the city with the Teamster, and we don't know what's going to happen. Is Robert De Niro going to show up? Does he have a lot of stuff to deal with? Was anybody hurt? What's happening? And I got there, and he was there. Spent a lot of time on the phone dealing with it. What I imagine was, how to handle the situation. Maybe he had employees that were scared. I don't know. I didn't talk to him about that. But he showed up for work, and he was resolute and strong. Yeah, he wasn't afraid. For me, it seemed like an awkward time to be meeting him and be working with him. But he was pretty unfazed. And we talked about it a bit. I'm reluctant to sort of talk about whatever conversations we had, almost about anything, because I know there are sort of parasitical outlets that want to paraphrase things. So I don't want to do any paraphrasing myself and fuel a fire. But we did have some other conversations a bit. I didn't know the scene that I'm doing is relatively tight. But it is, you know, we had to shoot it a lot, and we had to, you know, sort of be with each other in the hallway in between takes. And we talked a bit about movies. We talked a bit about Ray Liotta. We talked a bit about the King of Comedy. He's a very sweet guy, very soft-spoken guy. But I was just very sort of amazed at his lack of fear in the face of what he had to deal with that morning and his professionalism. But on top of that, though, just the fact that he was not, it did not, from what I could tell, I can't speak for him, but he seemed just the resolve in terms of he just was not shaken. So it's fucked up. It's fucked up and even more frightening as we converge on this election. So just, I don't know where you are or what you're thinking in terms of this vote, but I got to mail my ballot in tomorrow. I'm in California, and this is one of those situations where you think your state government is solid, or that you don't have to engage. It's clear that that you have to engage and you have to vote, because there's no the falconer can't see the falcon, and then some strange beast is slouching towards Bethlehem, and something needs to give. And if it doesn't during this this midterm, I don't even know what's going to happen to the reality of this country, or certainly what's going to happen to the spirit of trying to correct things. Because this is a big mind fuck for everybody. Anyway, I'll lighten up a little bit. You know, I had a guest on not long ago named Aaron Draplin. He's a designer, a graphic designer, sort of a genius, sort of a compulsive genius, a man fascinated with the art of the logo. And he's an incredible artist in his own right, wrote an amazing book. We had a lovely interview. And we asked Aaron to do a special edition WTF shirt for us, and he did an amazing one. I put the picture on Twitter and Instagram so you can see what it looks like. And people who come to my show at the Beacon on November 10th here in New York City will have a first crack at it. That's the first place it's going to be on sale. So you Beacon people will be the first ones to wear it. Then afterwards, we'll have it for sale in the merch store so you can get them before the holiday. Draplin's amazing because he has an appreciation of graphic design, of logo art, of the history of it, that it just informs everything he does. It's a great shirt. So there's that. I didn't mention today that I had Zoe Kazan on. She's got a film that she co-wrote with Paul Dano, her partner, and they're not married, but they're together, and he directed it, and it's now playing in select cities. It's called Wildlife. We'll talk to her in a few minutes. I had a nice conversation with her. I enjoyed the movie. I watched it very intently. I like Paul Dano. I've talked to him before, so that's coming up. I guess I should talk a little bit about New York if I could, because I'm continuing feeling a bit alienated from it. And I guess I should, outside of the politics of the week and the slaughter and bloodletting of the week and the fucking horrendous terrorism that's happening in our country, I should say that my experience on the Joker was insanely exciting. Like I said, it's not a huge part. It's not a huge scene even, but to engage as an actor with Robert De Niro and with Joaquin Phoenix was pretty amazing. I didn't really talk to Joaquin Phoenix. He seems to be pretty submerged in his work, but it was sort of a baptism into a movie making that I had not, I had a little part in Almost Famous a million years ago, and I've done a couple little movies, but this was, you know, this was big time, and it was, and I was hoping I would do good work, and I think I did all right. It was funny because when we were doing the scene, De Niro, went to the director, and then the director comes to me, and there was this moment where it's like, you know, he said, "You're a little big at the end there, you know, so take it." So I had to make adjustments, did a little acting, but it was a great experience. I think it's going to be a pretty wild movie. It's definitely kind of hallucinatory to be, you know, on a film set that is a different world for, you know, 12, 13 hours a day. Anyway, that being said, to sort of move into more about New York that I was feeling the other day, which was nostalgia and what nostalgia means and the sort of darkness at the edge of it. Yeah, I used to always say that Los Angeles is horrible because it's a horrible place to feel, that you can feel very alone there and isolated. But I think New York, it's worse if you feel isolated in New York, you know, because I'm here, I'm stuck in Midtown, I'm in a hotel. There are things I want to do. There's always things. That's the other part about being in Manhattan is sort of the part of your brain is sort of like, geez, New York City, I should be out doing something. I should be out. Man, there's a million things going on there. So I got what am I? How come I'm not doing something? That feeling is kind of unnerving because that goes right to like everyone else is doing something but me. And then that goes to like I'm missing everything. And that goes to like, I'm a fucking loser. Look at me sitting here doing nothing. But those are old patterns. But I do think that being isolated in a city that's filled with people is definitely a worse feeling than being isolated in a city where you don't see anybody around. Because when you're in your own head among people, that's a type of loneliness that really kind of pounds at you because like they're all right there. Everyone's right there. We're all people. Why can't I feel connected to people? But when you're out in LA and you're sitting alone in your house, you're like, well, there's nobody around, so fuck it. It's different. And I think you can ground yourself in it a little differently. But I'm just sort of struggling with these feelings. And I need to go down. I should go down to the cellar, get a couple sets in here and there. But I haven't wanted to. And then I start to think about, you know, what the place used to be. I start thinking about how it was when Patrice O'Neal was around, when Greg Giraldo was around, and, you know, what's going on down there now. They changed the whole layout of the place. I don't know. It's just, I just have to sit with the fact that it's okay to just be in the hotel room, do my work, talk to you from the mic, do a little reading, fester about my diet, and walk around here, go shopping for almond milk and fruit. And that's okay. That's not a bad afternoon. And also that I'm an old middle-aged man now. I don't need to run around. What am I going to run around and do? You know what's interesting is that I watched my buddy Steve Brill directed the new Adam Sandler special on Netflix. And look, years ago, Sandler and I had a problem. I saw him recently at an event, and he was nice to me. I'd love to talk to him, but I was never... You know, I was a little older to be grabbed by the Sandler thing. I don't know if I would have been grabbed by the Sandler thing, but certainly I've known him and certainly I've liked some of the work he's done. But I'll tell you, this stand-up special it's a very touching, very personal, and oddly very Sandler special. And the effect of it, I watched the whole thing and I was very I was moved, and it was a great show. He's somehow able to maintain what makes him Sandler. From when, you know, you were a kid, if you grew up with him, but also to be mature and share the life he's living now and write some clever songs. And there's a joke in there about his dad that killed me. I squirted out a few tears. I laughed a few times. I enjoyed it. I'm just saying that because I don't know what some of you people think I am. And I think I've judged Adam harshly when I was younger and more angry. But I thought the special was great. And this isn't even a paid ad. Huh? What do you think of that? I'm just saying, a fellow comedian who I haven't seen do stand up in a long time, if ever really, for a whole hour, did a great stand up special. That's that. Why is it so hard for me just to say that? Why? Why do I got to be that? Why is it so hard? Huh? So Zoe Kazan, is here and not here. Well, I recorded it, you know, at home. But I watched the film Wildlife, and I watched it very intently, and I enjoyed it, and I thought it was beautifully shot and beautifully executed. She co-wrote the film with Paul Dano. He directed it, and it's now playing in select cities. And this is my conversation with her about her, okay? All right. But I grew up... in Albuquerque.
I like Albuquerque.
You do?
Yeah. But I've only spent like, you know, 2 weeks there shooting something.
You had to go there for the shooting.
Exactly. It's been 10 years.
10 years since you've been to Albuquerque to shoot things? It seems like everyone shoots there all the time. What'd you shoot there?
I shot in Santa Fe recently, but...
That's a little swankier.
Yeah, I shot a movie called In the Valley of Elah.
Oh, yeah. Who was in that movie?
Charlize Theron.
Yeah. That was like a big movie, wasn't it?
I don't know. I had a little part in it.
Oh, it was early on?
Yeah.
It was one of those, hey, hi.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go now parts.
Except like when you're a girl, it's like, hey, hi, I'm going to be naked and now you're going to kill me parts.
It was one of those?
Yeah, one of those.
That was what was in the breakdown?
Yeah.
Naked gets killed.
Yeah, it says must be okay with nudity on like the first 20 things that I did.
Yeah. Oh, I had to do that with Glow. It was only right. Right? Because all the women had to sign him. And what am I going to be like? No. So I signed one, and I showed my butt.
In what scene?
It was in the first season, you know, when I walked to the door after I swept with Kate Nash.
Oh, right.
And there's my butt, and I used my own butt.
How'd you feel about that?
It's all right. You know, I don't know how it would have felt if it was my front. Like, you know, because I guess what you have to take in mind is, like, this is going to live forever as a meme or on a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be always available.
Right. Yes, I know.
Your buddy Betty has a lot of those out there.
Oh, yeah. Betty and I both.
You do, too?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you feel about that?
Not good.
Not good to have nude things out
there. No, it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good. And, like, when you're then, like, trying to make deals.
Yeah.
And they're, like, 2 inches of her butt crack, you know?
Yeah.
Or, like, six frames of side boob or something. And you're like,
that's in your deal?
Yeah.
Like, that's,
yeah.
That's crazy.
Yep.
And that's a negotiating point.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're like, no, she doesn't want to do nudity. Mm-hmm. How about just a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. So then you end up with inches of butt crack.
Oh, and they actually measure it?
I have no idea.
Or is that just a general, so you've never been on a set and they're like, can we just get the ass measurer out?
No, but then what ends up happening is that on set someone goes like, you know, for the shot it would be better.
Right. Yeah they kind of weasel. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But did you grow up out here?
I did. I grew up in Venice Beach.
Venice Beach.
So when I watch Glow, it looks very familiar to me.
Yeah, because like, okay, so
I was born in 83.
Oh, right. So like those are your earliest memories.
For sure.
Women wearing that kind of stuff on the beach.
Yeah, and men looking just like you did.
Sure, just like me, acting like me.
Totally.
Yeah, it's
it was like every single one of my dad's friends.
I know, I think it's sort of nice about my character about Sam Sylvia is he does catch a break from the ladies, even given the climate we're living in, because he reminds them of people that they knew from their dad.
Yeah, like my pediatrician.
Oh, boy. Well, I don't think Sam's that terrible.
No, I don't either.
Yeah,
I'm in it in a good way.
No, I know. He's a little old school, a little sexist, but he's you know, he breaks down.
Sure.
Yeah.
You play it really well.
Thank you very much. That's very nice of you to say.
I love it.
And you're like best pals with Betty?
Yep. Betty and I go way back. She's one of my, you know, sister friends.
It took me a while. Like, the first season, I was just scared of her.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, I don't know even how to talk to that person.
Huh.
And I don't usually have that problem.
Really?
Well, I just was sort of like, she's intense. But then second season, Betty and I were better. It was good.
Yeah.
I love her. I think she's great.
Yeah, me too. I first met Betty when she was at the Williamstown Theater Festival with some friends of mine.
Where's that? Williamstown?
Williamstown, Massachusetts.
Okay, yeah. I wasn't sure.
And I remember seeing her from far away and thinking she looked really confident. And then, you know, getting to know her and realizing that she had a lot of work to do on that front. And
now
she's like soaring. It's beautiful.
What's interesting to me in talking about Glow, and I don't know if I've said it publicly, is that, you know, Allison came up here and she's very much a product of this business.
Right.
And Betty's like New York theater. So you get these two completely different approaches in a way.
Yeah.
And experience with acting.
Right.
That are kind
totally.
Of going head to head.
Yeah.
And it's pretty
Betty
cool.
Betty and I have that in common. We both came up in the theater. So it's one of the things that, like, you know, we met probably in audition rooms long before we became friends.
So how does it work? So you grew up in Venice Beach and you have the sister that I think I met once.
Maya.
Maya, who lived by Sarah, my girlfriend, Sarah the painter. And that's it? Just one sister?
Just the two of us, yeah.
And you grew up in show business, really?
Yeah, sort of.
I don't know what that's like. Is that like, but like in the sense it's sort of like, it's just what your parents did.
Exactly. And also I grew up with like screenwriter parents. So I grew up with two people who are like sitting at home hunched in front of their computers.
Did they write together?
Yeah, they wrote two movies together, one of which got made, this movie, this children's movie, Matilda, they wrote together. Yeah. And then they've both written a bunch separately.
They're working screenwriters.
Both of them. Yep.
They're writing right now?
Yep.
As we speak.
Well, not as we speak.
No, but I mean, do you know what they're working on? Do they talk to you about it?
Yeah, sure. My mom talks to me about it more than my dad. My dad's more secretive.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They have separate writing rooms?
Yeah.
But you also are a legacy, right?
Right. My grandpa is a director.
Your grandpa was a director. Aaliyah Kazan.
Yeah, that's right.
I know his movie. I didn't know how to pronounce his first name.
There you go. You did really good.
Did you? No, I didn't. I did it wrong, and he corrected me.
Oh, that's okay. No,
but did you know him?
Yeah, he died when I was 20.
Oh, and was he pretty cognizant all to the end?
Yeah, totally. You know, I feel like I got the best of him as a grandfather, sort of, because he was like 75 when I was born, so he was like ready to be a grandparent.
Was he retired completely?
He was sort of retired. He didn't make any movies or direct any plays after I was born, but he wrote his autobiography after I was born and was still writing until he died.
Did you read his autobiography?
Never.
Never did?
Mm-mm.
Huh.
Yeah, I skimmed through it.
Yeah.
Like, actually just in the last year, and was like, I never need to read this.
Why? You just want to know all that stuff? Like, there's certain things as a granddaughter you don't need to know about your grandfather.
Yeah, there's a lot, I think, about his sex life in it. But also, it's like, you know, you have a personal experience with someone, and then the world has an experience of them. And I feel like there's some part of me that just wants to protect my own experience of him.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But like coming up when you were a kid, like when you started to sort of realize who he was, did you go watch his movies? Did they inform you in any way?
I didn't know that he was a director until I was like 12.
Uh-huh.
I knew he was like a powerful person because of the way people treated him.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't really know what he did, and no one ever talked to me about it. And well, you know, growing up in LA, like every kid I knew, their parents were basically in the industry. You know, like
why'd you go to one of those schools?
No, but like
it was just the way it was.
It's just the way it was. Like my two best friends growing up, both their dads were film editors.
Uh-huh.
Like another one of my friends, like, had two parents who were working actors, like jobbing actors.
Yeah.
And another friend's dad was like a carpenter for the movies. You know, like
yeah.
So it just didn't seem that weird. I don't know, like he was just my grandpa. And then I went to a different school for middle school, and
yeah,
my middle school drama teacher said, oh, are you related to, which is the first time that had ever happened to me. And she said his name, but she said it wrong.
Yeah, like I did.
Uh-huh. And also I called him Aaliyah Papu because Papu is Greek for grandfather.
Yeah.
And I was like, my grandpa's name is Aaliyah Papu. And then, you know, went home and asked my parents about it. And then they showed me, I think Viva Zapata was the first one I saw.
Oh, yeah.
Seems like kind of child friendly.
Yeah, and then On the Waterfront.
Mm-hmm. And then On the Waterfront and Streetcar. I think those four.
You know what's really hard to find for a while was Facing the Crowd.
Yeah.
And that's the best fucking movie, man.
It's pretty apropos of right now, right?
It's absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's just a crazy movie. I mean, I remember when I saw it, I'm like, why didn't I know about this? Because I saw it like within the last decade,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah, me too.
You did too?
Yeah, I didn't see it until like 4 or 5 years
ago. It just wasn't one of those ones that was easily available. You had to order, like, I don't remember where I saw it or why I saw it, but I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, that and Panic in the Streets I hadn't seen until recently.
Yeah, and like, I guess the big ones were like Splendor in the Grass, right? That was his, and East of Eden, On the Waterfront, and then the other one, Streetcar.
Streetcar, yeah.
Yeah, those were big movies.
Yep.
But you know, like I just don't like I think it's interesting that like a lot of people don't really realize, you know, people have a certain concept of celebrity and of, you know, the movies, but it is an industry town. And like the fact that, like, you know, carpenters in the movie, like, you know, it's like this industry employs all levels of workers.
Yeah.
And it's just like the business.
Yeah, so, yeah, completely. Costume designers, yeah. Like, yeah.
And it's crazy, like that it sometimes annoys me, people's impression of like Hollywood. It's like it's a big fucking machine, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it only, sometimes it used to annoy me at first when I first started out acting, and people would be like, oh, you're like Hollywood royalty or something. I'd be like, right. Like, that is so far away from the way I was raised. You know, like, I was raised in such a grounded way. And
By writers,
yeah. Exactly, who are like the biggest introverts in the world, yeah. And so like loving and like such a, I don't know, like, we sat down as a family for dinner every single night of
my
childhood.
That's a nice thing about having writers.
Completely, they could be at home. Exactly.
They take a break. They
yeah, exactly.
Come out of their room.
That's exactly right. Chop up some garlic, throw in the pasta.
And then go back into their rooms.
That's exactly right.
So you probably, I just had to deal with that in, you know, telling somebody I was going to interview. You're like, no, those royalty, those, how, like, it's easier for them.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. I don't think it, well, why is it?
Well, I can't pretend to know, right? Because I only know what I know. But I would assume that it is slightly easier at the beginning to get a meeting
right.
or something.
Sure,
right?
Or like, with an agent or with whoever.
Yeah,
right.
I bet it would be foolish to think that didn't give me some kind of leg up.
Right.
I think the real thing is that it doesn't give you an advantage for very long.
Exactly. You got to deliver the goods.
Yeah, but like, or no one will hire you again.
Right, but your entry in is a little smoother.
I would guess that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when did you decide to... like that was something you wanted to do? Because I can't believe both you and your sister are doing it.
Yeah, my sister's an actor too. I think I did as soon as I knew what kind of a job that was.
Yeah.
Like, I remember.
You saw it as a job first, not as like, I want to be a movie star?
No, not at all, yeah.
You're like, that seems like a good job.
Yeah, I think I think as a very little kid, it didn't seem like, I didn't really understand what an actor did, right?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
You watch movies and it's just like the people on the screen.
Yeah.
And then probably at like 9 or 10, it sort of occurred to me that was a job. That was something people could do, like play pretend for a living. And,
play
and
pretend,
seemed like, that seemed like a good job. But I wanted to be a writer before I wanted to be an actor. So that one came first. And
it
then,
did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did you start writing things for things?
Like before I could spell.
But like writing, what did you think, writing for movies or just writing?
I thought I wanted to be like a poet.
Oh, yeah, sure. Poets. Mm-hmm. That's a good job.
Great job. Very lucrative.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
A lot
of security.
Totally.
In the poet game.
Yeah, you can be secure that you're never going to make any money.
You can be secure that if you don't get a teaching job, it's not going to really pan out.
Yeah, that's right. So I wrote a lot of poetry and then stories and then...
How do those poems hold up? Zoe,
you know, they're little kids' poems.
You do say Zoe, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
What, like Zoe?
Yeah, some people do that.
Do you know, so I think they do that partially because Zoe Caldwell was like a famous actress.
Uh-huh.
And her parent, when I met her, I said, oh, people always call me Zoe because of you. And she said, oh, my parents didn't know how to pronounce the name. They mispronounced her name for her life. By the time I was in high school, I was like, you know, writing little plays and...
acting them out?
Well, I started doing that as a kid. I mean, I feel partially to blame for my sister's acting career because I enlisted her into my projects as a little kid.
What's the age difference?
We're 3 years apart.
She's younger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
starting at probably 5 or 6, I started, you know, putting on little plays on our futon in our living room.
For your folks?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Were they proud? Look, they're writers. Look, she's a writer.
I don't know. I think they were a little trepidatious. When I told them I wanted to be an actor, they were pretty upset.
Isn't that interesting about people in show business? Mm-hmm. It's like, can't you do anything else?
I know.
I can't. Do you want a life of heartbreak?
Why don't you be a scientist?
Yeah. Why the rejection? Why do you crave this horrible thing?
You know, when I was graduating high school, I wanted to go to conservatory, and my parents told me that they wouldn't, you know, pay for it. They wouldn't help me if that's what I did.
They wanted you to go to college?
They wanted me to go to college, so I did. And I think it was one of the better parenting moves they ever made.
Oh, yeah. Decide after you go get an education.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I'm so grateful to have my mind.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's good. So you acted in high school?
I acted in high school. I wanted to act professionally. They were like dead set against it.
Did you go out for stuff in high school?
Absolutely not.
They wouldn't let you?
Mm-mm. They wouldn't let me.
But you could have.
Yeah, but, you know, I had like producers and stuff like give my parents their cards at like my school plays and things.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they were like, no. And I was pretty devastated. I thought they were ruining my life.
Oh, yeah. You could have been. Yeah. They ruined your life. You could have been one of those weird child stars that kind of like everyone looks at in a bizarre way at this point.
Well, look.
Oh, that's what happened to her. She was so cute in that thing. Yeah. Remember when she was 7? Mm-hmm. Remember when she was 12?
Yep.
You, boy, you dodged a bullet on that one.
Yep. But I agree completely. But at the time, I thought that they were like actively trying to ruin my life.
So, okay. So the big fight at the Kazan household was like, why can't I go to conservatory?
Mm-hmm. And then I applied to regular school and, you know, learned how to think. And
where'd you go?
Yale.
You went to Yale and you didn't study acting?
Well, there's a misperception of the acting school at Yale that's really famous is Graduate.
Right.
So I did undergrad theater, like I was doubled with English and theater and did a bunch of plays there, which was a good chunk of my education. But, you know, I studied other stuff.
Yeah, what did you major in English?
Mm-hmm. English and theater. And I took a bunch of writing classes.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, the stuff that I remember, the stuff that I think like I should have done more of that is the stuff that I had to do for my requirements.
Like
bioethics. Seriously. Because I remember that stuff way more than I remember I remember
Chaucer.
Like, yeah, exactly. That's
right.
Yes. Exactly.
Well, yeah, sure, because they're bioethics, you know, you're weighing, like, they're, you know, there's like, is this right or is this wrong? This is the scenario, sort of like, it sort of resonates with you because it challenges you morally.
Yeah, totally. And also, it's a part of my brain I had never used before. So it was making
you never weighed out right and wrong before?
Yes, I lived a completely amoral existence until then.
That's what did it?
Yeah.
The bioethics class?
Yep.
Thank God for bioethics.
Set me straight.
Boy, I was heading down a bad road. Just didn't know the difference. So, all right. Well, you know, there's still time for that. You know, you can sort of brush up on that stuff on your own. You
know, I think about it. I think about going back to school.
You do?
You?
Really?
Yeah.
I'm 55. That whole back to school thing is faded into the past.
I think about it like a pipe dream.
I tried it once in my 30s.
And?
Yeah, I was living in New York, and I can't remember. It must have been in my mid-30s, and I'm like, I'm going to take a class at the new school. I'm going to take a philosophy class.
Yeah.
And I was just smoking a lot of pot, and I don't know what I was thinking, but it was hard, and the teacher didn't like me.
Yeah.
And I became a smart ass, and I didn't do my homework. It was exactly like I was in college. Like, nothing had changed. There was no kind of like, I'm grown up now. I can handle
right.
It was ridiculous.
I really struggled in my philosophy classes in school.
Well, you want it just to be like, are we going to talk? And it's like, it's not that. You got to learn the language, and some of them are more logic oriented.
It was just so much more like math than anything I could have expected. Yeah, I hated it.
I took a class in college called Symbolic Logic, and I don't know what the fuck it was about. I have no idea.
Where did you go to school?
Boston University.
It's a good school.
I guess, I was English major. You know, I did, it enabled me to do what I wanted to do and then wrangle a major together.
That's exactly what I did. And I really, there's a huge part of me that's like, I wish that I was still in the mindset of trying to get straight A's, you know?
Oh, wow. It's a good mindset to be in.
I guess. I don't know. Like, I was still in like wanting to impress my teachers, to take classes I'd be good at, you know?
Yeah.
And then now I'm like, oh, what a waste of time.
Really?
Yeah, like, well, in terms of, yeah, in the big picture, like, what does it matter if my teachers liked me?
Well, I guess that's true, but if you were getting straight A's, you were engaging with the material on some level. Maybe it benefited you in ways you don't quite appreciate because, you know, it's somehow like you're down on yourself for not taking more challenging, difficult, or seemingly uninteresting classes.
You're absolutely right. It's just one more way of me trying to be an A student. Yes, absolutely.
Like,
you're
if
correct.
Only I would have, you know.
Oh,
like,
you're right.
To this day, I don't think I can write a good paper.
Hmm.
Like, I never even really, I can write. I've written books. But, like, if you were to tell me to write a term paper on something, I just could not. I don't know why I couldn't wrap my brain around it. It usually ended up like 10 pages of opening paragraphs.
Uh-huh.
I just couldn't focus in and break it down.
My philosophy professors were like, you do this thing in your philosophy papers where you like try to make a surprise ending. No surprise endings. Lay out what you're going to say, then say it.
Yeah. Yeah. So after Yale, you've gotten your liberal arts education.
Right.
And your parents are happy.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, now I'm going to do it.
Yeah. So 4 years of school decided, made me think I wanted more school.
Yeah.
And so I applied to graduate school.
At Yale.
And I got told, come back next year after you've like had a little life experience.
For the theater program.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, I'm going to take a year in New York and then I'll apply again and I'll go back to school.
Yeah.
And I got to New York and I had like a really wild year. And
good wild?
Yeah. And also bad wild.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end of it, I didn't want to go back. And I started having panic attacks. And I had to call up the head of the program and be like, I'm having panic attacks.
The head of Yale?
Mm-hmm. And he was like, I don't think you want to come.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't think I want to come either. And then about a month later, I got my first job.
So when this is the first time you live away from home. And are you doing weird little plays? Are you like, what's wild good and wild bad?
I took a lot of acting classes.
With?
At a place called the Actors Center that doesn't exist anymore.
Huh. Never heard that one. I've talked to a lot of actors about New York acting places and I haven't heard that one.
There's an actress named Mojan Marnot who is on a show called The Blacklist.
Yeah.
And she was at Yale Drama when I was Yale undergrad. And yeah. I saw her in a play and I thought she was really good. And I wrote her and said, where did you study? And she said, I studied at the Actors Center. And so I applied there. And I took like a year of class there.
Where was that?
It was in the mid-20s.
Uh-huh.
And the nice thing about that school is they hired a lot of people from graduate programs who are like looking to make a little extra money.
Sure.
On the side. So I started with this teacher called Ron Van Loo, who teaches at Yale Drama.
Yeah.
And
so you got it. You got the Yale education.
I got a little bit of it.
Yeah.
And like took like mask class and clown class.
Oh, you did all that
voice
stuff.
Production, movement. Yeah, it was really fun.
So it wasn't necessarily an industry driven class, but it was not method.
No.
It was, you did all the things. I talked to are you guys married, you and Paul?
No, we're not married, but okay. He's like my.
Yeah,
whatever.
No, I know, your partner and you have a baby. But I remember when I was talking to him, I said, because like, I didn't always talk to actors.
Right.
Until I started sort of acting.
Mm-hmm.
Because and I've always been curious about it since I was in college. And I would see what the training was. But I remember asking him, do you ever do animal work? And he was like, I do.
He does. He says hi, by the way.
Oh, yeah. That was great. Yeah. I was so happy that he was honest about it. Yeah. Copping to animal work is not a regular thing you have to do in conversation.
Oh, for sure. We both have.
Well, okay, so masks and clowning.
Yeah, which was great and also like really put me out of my comfort zone. And
what is mask work, really?
Well, it's like the idea of putting on an archetype and then letting that archetype like inform what your body
like commedia dell'arte kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So like these Balinese masks that this uh-huh. mask teacher named Per Bra works uh-huh. with, and I learned a ton, and then I also like did a lot of like weird kind of jobs, drank a lot, and
oh yeah,
had
got messy.
Yeah,
had what? A lot of what?
A lot of sex.
Uh-huh.
And like, like learned how to take care of myself. Like I remember one
by doing those two things.
No, I remember waking up one morning and like I was subletting this apartment that had radiator heat, and you can't control it. So like it was really really hot and dry when I woke up, and I went to the fridge and the only cold thing was a beer, and I opened it and drank it, and then I was like standing there in my kitchen like this is probably not good.
Yeah. 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 First thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's... But, you know, I was 22.
Yeah, it's okay to do it then.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the time you should learn that lesson.
Yeah.
As opposed to make a life out of it. Good for you. You went the right way.
I guess so.
Those heaters were the worst.
They're though. The worst.
And they'd have the knob on there. And you're like, is this even doing anything? And then someone goes, no, the whole system's connected to one thing. You're like, fuck.
And you're sleeping with all the windows open to try to regulate the heat.
In winter.
In the middle of the winter.
And the hissing, the fucking hissing.
Yeah.
And then you couldn't touch them.
I didn't know how to do anything. Like, my laundry was never done.
Oh, so
like,
you had the, you were a pile person?
Not just a pile person, but like I'd run out of underwear and then I would just like go without underwear for like a week. Like it was just like really, really a lot of learning. Because I had never like, I had just never like lived like an adult.
Yeah, I felt that when I got out of school. I didn't know how to rent an apartment or, you know, any of that.
Totally.
It's the worst.
Just like loosed and like, and like not having any money, but also like, you know, I grew up in upper middle class family. Like, it wasn't like there was no safety net, but like, you also are like, okay, I need to learn how to, like function and make a budget and like, you know, you're paying your own rent for the first time and how do I do that?
And drink.
Yeah. And, well, drink, that wasn't a problem because I was a girl. So I drank for free.
Right.
For like a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like for 3 years, I drank for free.
Uh-huh.
And then I got a boyfriend and then, you know, I got older and don't drink for free anymore.
Right. And not as much.
Thank God. I moved out of the East Village. That helped me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I spent time there. So, okay. So masks, clowns.
Yeah, my clown teacher was named Jane Anderson, and she was great, and I was really, I really struggled with the clown stuff.
Yeah.
It was really, really hard for me.
Why? Too broad?
No, I think I was trying to control other people's perception of me, and I think I didn't like to, you have to like be willing to expose the most foolish part of yourself, and I think I didn't want that exposed at 22.
And you couldn't quite frame that into your the way of thinking of like, you know, I can get A's as a clown.
Like I think I was trying to get A's as a clown and trying to do that without being honest.
So you think clown work is a very honest form?
I do.
Hmm.
I think it's super, super honest. And I really worked on it. I used to do my dishes with my nose on.
Yeah.
Yeah. See what it did to my body.
Did you eventually nail it or what?
I think I got better.
Yeah. And then what was the practical stuff that you learned?
Like scene study class and stuff like that. That was what I took with Ron and that was really great. And again, you know, actually, I don't know if you took a lot of acting class or not, but what I have found is that if the teacher is really good and I really want to impress them, I'm not going to learn a lot by doing scenes in class, that I learn much more from watching other people do scenes.
Yeah.
Like, I learned a ton in the scene work that I did, but I kind of learned it like 6 months after the fact.
Right.
And then getting to observe like an actor on stage and what you think is like getting in their way and then what the teacher identifies as like, and then it helps you see yourself and something shifts in yourself. Like,
right.
I feel like my need to please is so high that, or it was a decade ago.
Yeah.
That it took me watching to really learn something.
Right. No, that makes sense. But it seems like being present and listening is kind of key.
Yeah. That one.
But it's tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because like to get to a place where you're not just thinking about, okay, here comes I'm about to say what I'm going to say.
Sure. Oh,
here it comes. Look at that other person acting. She's good. Wow. Okay. Oh, hi. Yeah. Then you kind of.
Yeah. Or like the thing of like doing all your homework and then trying to show that you did all your homework.
Yeah. I'm not good at homework with anything.
Mm.
I'm a sort of like last minute-y kind of load up my head kind of person.
Right.
And sometimes that works. But like I think making choices is the trick, right? In
right.
a lot of ways. Like, I mean, I do prepare, but like backstory doesn't help me.
Hmm.
Does it help you?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
I did a play in college and, the student director I worked with was like all about backstory and she made us like write these elaborate autobiographies and actually like we were doing The Crucible and like, it's all everything that we invented took us further away from the play.
I would think so.
Like, it, I think those, I think that character autobiography or whatever is only helpful if it helps you engage with what's actually there.
Well, that's the thing. That's one, the one thing that, like, I gleaned, you know, and I was judgmental of David Mamet's approach early on. But I think it is on the page. And I think that if you trust the writers, that you're going to find your way to that person. Do
yeah,
you?
I do. I agree with you.
So you start doing theater?
Yeah. So I got...
You did a lot of theater.
I did a lot of theater. I've done like a dozen plays.
Like big plays.
Yeah.
From like when you were like just what... When did you first start doing that?
I was 22, about to turn 23 when I did my first play in New York. I did The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie with Cynthia Nixon at the New Group off Broadway.
The New Group. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah.
And you were 22.
I turned 23 during that production.
And now, did you know Cynthia?
I had never met her until my callback for that.
And how was that? Was she great?
She was great. I will say, like, you know, in terms of that, like, Hollywood royalty, like, you have it easy kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, I was so eager to dispel that. Like, I think that's part of the reason that I worked so hard at the beginning, is that I really wanted people to never be able to say that about me.
You never thought of changing your name?
No. Mm. I like my name.
Yeah.
My name.
Yeah, I get it. Some people change them, though.
Yeah, I know.
But then
that's a lie. I did think about it. I just didn't think about it for very long.
Right.
Anyways, I memorized the entire play for the callback because I thought they might throw something else at me, and they did. And I was already off book. So I got like, I gave myself a big leg up.
Yeah.
And I got that part, I think partially because I was that prepared. And Cynthia was great and taught me a ton. And she was also, didn't hold my hand in the least. And that was also really good.
And you were the two major characters?
Yeah.
But what when you just taught by being with her, or she actually...
just by being with her. Yeah. And then actually, like, there were, like, this guy named Richie Koster, an actor named Matt Rausch, and an actor named John Pankow, and they were all in that play with me, and they really took care of me and were, like, great, like, gave me great feedback. Scott Elliott, who directed it, taught me a ton and was amazing. And I just, like, kept my ears open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, because it must have been just electrifying to be on a real stage with real grown-ups.
Yeah.
It's heavy, man. Theater's, like, intense.
Yeah. Well, like, I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel like the older I've gotten, the more justification I have for confidence and the less confident I am. Like, the amount of confidence I had at 22, 23 was so much bigger than my ability.
Right.
What? And I think, like, if I hadn't had that confidence, I wouldn't have gotten through those first years where everything is so hard and you're getting rejected all the time. But, like, it is like a form of self-delusion.
Fake it till you make it.
For sure.
Yeah, no, I and there's a swagger to it. I mean, I think most people that get into this racket are, like, you know, sensitive, relatively insecure people that, you know, and you're acting confident. And
totally.
I mean, it's like you have to. You have to delude yourself in this business, you know, and it can go either way.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, and if you're too far gone in the delusion, you don't know when it's over. And I think it probably goes the same where you don't know if, like, sometimes you know, how well you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I find that I'm a little better at that. I'm a little more, I can say, like, well, that was good. Or there was some, like, you do a take and they're like, all right, we got it. And you're like, I don't know if they did.
But yeah.
If they saw something, I'm not going to write them on it.
Yeah. I don't know, though. Like, I just did this Coen Brothers movie that...
Oh, the Ballad of...
Buster Scruggs.
You haven't seen it yet. I want to see it, but it's not on yet.
It's really... I think the movie's wonderful. I love it, but...
I love them.
They're... Oh my God, they're the greatest. They're the greatest.
Yeah.
But there's, like, there are two scenes in it that on the day I was super unhappy with. And one of them, I think, it actually turned out really good. And the other one, I think, is not my strongest work. And, like... you know, on the day on both of them, I felt like I walked away being like, "Ooh, I could have done better that day."
But isn't that moment though where you have to trust the director on some level? I mean,
you do. Well, you do when it's like the Coen Brothers,
right? But there is that moment where you're like, if you felt disconnected or whatever the fuck it was that you didn't feel good about, you're going to see it again
for sure.
And then you just sort of, and that, then the problem with that is if you can't let it go and people come up to you and go, hey, that was really great. You're like, hey, I wasn't quite.
I know. Well, you know, especially in the theater, you do that like to the umpteenth degree because you're doing it every single night. You're doing the same thing every single night for months on end. And like, you start to really feel like there's a massive difference between your good nights and your bad nights.
Yeah.
And actually the difference is like, you know, millimeters.
And some of it can be just your relationship with the audience.
Totally.
Yeah.
Or like on a night where like the theater is really cold and like they react differently.
Or Sunday matinee when there's only half a house.
Yep. Or Friday when they're drunk.
Oh, believe me, as a comic, I know about that, the second show thing.
Oh, it's so rough.
Because you can hear it before you go on.
Absolutely. So before every night, before I go on stage, yeah, when I'm doing a play, I stand in the wings and listen to the noise of the audience because you can tell. What they're going to be like. Yeah,
you can. Yeah. No doubt. If you spend enough of your life on stage and you just like sit there, and if it's sort of like, nah, like, oh no.
The worst.
And sometimes you can be like, that guy's going to be a problem. That one guy.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Oh God.
You just know you're up against a diminished attention span.
Uh-huh.
And just like chatter. Ugh.
What's the best night as a stand-up comic?
Thursday.
That's the best night in the theater.
Yeah.
Thursday nights are the best nights in the theater.
Sunday's good if you happen to be working on Sunday, just if you want to fucking, you know, work shit out. But I have found that Saturday's first show are oddly the worst.
Huh.
Because I think everyone's landed in their life. They've had a day at home. And I don't know what their expectations are or why their energy's weird. But it's always sort of like, you know, we only get out once a week.
Right.
And, you know, how am I not going to disappoint them?
Wednesday matinees and Friday and Saturday nights, I think, are the worst nights in the theater. Some people say Tuesday nights because it's the first night back.
Yeah.
From the day off.
But. Yeah. Now, in your mind, when you were doing theater, were you like, this is what I'm going to be? I'm going to be one of these theater people?
Honestly, at the beginning, I just wanted to work.
Yeah.
You know, and like people ask, I mean, they must do this to you too. People ask me, like journalists will be like, how did you like plan out your career? And I'm like, oh, give me a break.
I'm lucky to have one.
Yeah, for real. And also like, I'm also like, it could have gone the other way so easily in terms of what work I got. Like,
yeah.
I auditioned for every CW show, every ABC Family show. I just didn't get those jobs.
And it's weird. I would imagine that in your 20s, you were somebody who could have played teenager.
Yeah.
And you probably went out a lot for that stuff.
Yeah, I did.
Did you get those?
Mm-mm. Sometimes, but like always like a teenager with problems.
You're the troubled teen?
No, like I just never got the like, you know, I don't know, like I could not pretend to be a different person than I was.
Right.
Or kind of thing. Like,
yeah.
You can't fool the world about your like essential essence, right? Like,
I think that's probably true. You know, eventually it'll come out.
Well, as being on the other side of the table, like I've written 4 plays and had them produced, and when you're sitting on the casting side and someone comes in, you can smell like, sometimes it's like, oh, don't even bother auditioning. Like, yeah. you're not the right animal. Like,
right.
The wrong animal came in the room, and it's just the wrong animal for the part, and right. It's not your fault, and you can be the best actor in the world, and it can still be wrong.
Interesting.
And that sort of, like, helped me start to, you know, be a little kinder to myself after it didn't go well on something.
No, like, change your expectations.
Yeah. I don't know. There was some, like, Americana show on ABC or CBS or something that I went in for at, like, 23, and the casting director, like, I walked in the room, she was like, oh, honey, this isn't your part. And I was like, oh God. And I drove all the way out to Burbank, mm-hmm. You know, and like, you know, learned 20 pages of lines or whatever. Yeah.
I don't know how you guys do it.
Like, it's a weird life.
Because I was always stand up, and anytime I'd go in, just sitting outside of the room, I'm like, this ain't for me. Like, it took me full, like, I had an arch, however I landed in my body, like, I know my wheelhouse, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, I just got a little part in a movie, and it's in Boston, and I told my managers, I'm like, if they want a Boston accent, it'll be ridiculous. So let's get that out of the way, because I can't do this. I'm not going to sit there like, pack, what? It's not going to happen. I mean, oddly, if you just plant me in a city long enough, I'll talk like whoever I'm around. Uh-huh. but I couldn't manufacture it. And thank God they're like, no, I don't care. And I'm like, perfect.
Great.
I'll do it. So I can just be me? Yep. Great. I'm good. I've gotten better at that.
I also just like would go, I just like, you know, I just treated everything like it was Chekhov, I think, a little bit. Like there was this.
You did the seagull?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know what that means. So explain that to.
So, I mean, like I took every audition really seriously.
Yeah.
Like there was this sitcom called Kath and Kim that was an Australian sitcom and they were going to make an American version of it. And they were like, the breakdown was like, she's disgusting. She like is like fat and sloppy and all this stuff. Like that was the breakdown. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I like put on like clothes that didn't fit and like didn't wear makeup, and I walked in and it was like 20 girls all wearing cute blue jeans and a cute top and like wearing a lot of makeup. And I was like, oh, right. Well, like they don't actually. And then they cast like Selma Blair. And I was like, okay, right. I just misunderstood the assignment again. Like, I'll never forget. I auditioned for this horror movie. It was about a girl being eaten from the inside out by a demon.
Yeah.
And, like, it describes her face, like, peeling off.
Uh-huh.
And, like, my feedback from my callback was, can she come in wearing a cute top and more makeup? I was like, okay. Always misunderstanding.
But how'd you handle the peeling back? And did you?
I said, I'm not coming back in if that's my feedback. Which I didn't do very often, but I was really mad at them. I was really mad that like...
Because you put that work in?
Yeah, because I like put a lot of like demonic possession work in.
Yeah, and they didn't care.
They just wanted to see my tits.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes in horror movies.
Yep.
Well, it seems like you've transcended that.
Well, that's nice.
Now, when you say you've written four plays over the years. Now, did you work in a collective of any kind? Were you part of a playwrights group or anything, or you just did them?
No. So I started my first play when I was at school in a playwriting class with this writer called Donald Margulies, great playwright. And I started this play in that class. And then when I was in that like first couple years in New York and I was like drinking too much and sleeping with too many people, I thought, okay, I'm going to destroy myself if I just sit around waiting for acting jobs.
Right.
Like, I'll just become, like, a monster. And so I picked up that play again, and I finished it, and I gave it to my agent. And a lit agent in my agency agreed to represent me, and that play ended up being produced at the Humana Festival.
Uh-huh.
In
what was
Louisville.
It called?
It was called Absalom.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've written three more plays since, and I've had them all produced, which was a mixed bag, but I learned a ton.
So you can get them all at French's, like in that little in the little books.
Yeah, you can get them all in the little books.
That's exciting.
It is exciting. Yeah. That's kind of one of the nice parts about
it. Well, as an actor, you know those little books.
Yeah,
and like to see your name on one of those little books.
It's pretty nice.
Yeah,
yeah, that part's nice.
Isn't that the name of the publishing company? Is it French's? Or
Samuel French is one of them.
Yeah.
Mine are DPS, Dramatic Publishing Services, or something.
Same little book, though?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, a little script book.
Yeah.
That's
you get to pick out the color for the...
You do?
Yep.
Oh, that's the victory.
Yeah.
So anytime it gets produced anywhere, they give you a few cents?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
So I never belonged to a collective. It's just something I've done to try to keep my brain alive.
And it seems like you found most of your success, fortunately, I think probably in retrospect, in film. I mean, even though you tried for all these TV shows,
yeah,
like the standard kind of like three camera, you know, jokies or whatever they are.
Yeah.
And like, I think that can somehow be sort of limiting. And again, you might have dodged a bullet by not being a recurring on a 8-year sitcom.
Totally. I mean, totally. I will say that like, it seems like now all the bets are off in terms of like career trajectory, and, you know,
in
like,
terms of knowing how it's going to go, or what do you mean?
I mean, in terms of what a show means,
right,
or what, you know, people can do a web series and it launches them. Like,
right,
I think
right,
it's
right,
really great.
Sure.
Like, there's something more democratic about what's happening now than what was happening 10 years ago.
And
right?
Also, like, yeah, and also it's so fragmented that, you know, great shows can be on that no one's ever heard of.
Totally.
That's the downside of the democratization.
That's
is that
completely right.
Like, you know, what's that on? You know, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. No, it's genius. What I don't have enough time.
I don't watch nearly enough of what is out there, but that's okay.
But you have nice parts, like I've seen, like in the Olive Kitteridge thing.
Yeah.
That was great, you know, and you get to work with her.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, she's a, like, just like, she's something, huh?
Fran's the best.
Fran, she's like, so like, she's so in it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, whatever, I met her briefly and she was so nice to me, but she was sort of like, I know you. And I'm like, wow, that's enough. That's good. That's so exciting that you yeah. know me.
I mean, she's sort of my hero. I mean, more than sort of. And yeah, so getting to work with her on that was kind of like a career high.
She's your hero in the sense of how she handles herself as an actress, or?
Yeah, like an acting hero. Uh-huh. Like, I don't like the word idol, but mm-hmm. like that, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
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 I mean, there are so many women of her generation and just older than her that I admire and look up to, like Jane Fonda and, mm-hmm. you know, Sally Field and all these, the, you know, incredible generation of actresses, Sissy Spacek.
I just talked to her.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, how is that?
Great. She's so great. She's a very generous, nice, you know, kind, you know, thoughtful person that kind of lives a life, a private life, and does this amazing work.
Yeah.
You know?
She's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Profound.
But Fran also, like, seems like totally one of a kind, ballsy person.
Yeah, exactly. And she's from the New York theater scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
She is.
And you work with her husband with the on yeah. the Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah.
Well, how did those guys direct?
Well.
No, but I mean, like, what's the relationship like with the actor?
You know, I didn't have a lot of contact with them before we shot.
Yeah.
I auditioned for them twice.
Yeah.
For that part, and I didn't get a whole lot of information during those auditions, except that they laugh when they like something, and so I had a little tiny bit of that kind of feedback,
yeah,
and a little bit of guidance. And they've been working with the same cast and crew, I mean the same crew, for like 30 years for the most part, and so every person that you're meeting, every collaborator, sort of is like meeting a part of their brain.
Yeah.
So like my work with Mary Zofries, the costume designer, gave me as much information as they did probably personally. And then they're very unassuming and relaxed seeming.
Yeah. Yeah.
They definitely hear things in a really precise way. Like they're hearing the music of their film in their head very specifically and precisely, and it's in the writing very specifically and precisely. If you ever read one of their scripts, they're written the way you see the movie, like with camera angles, and you can really see the movie on the page. And they also give you the storyboards on your sides in the morning, so you can see like what
how it's situated.
Yeah, exactly. So there's just like a ton of information there that's unspoken.
Precise.
Yeah.
Not much wiggle room.
There's wiggle room performance-wise.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, but...
And they love character actors.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
It's great. Tim Blake Nelson.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see the movie. I it's weird because... did you see Hail Caesar?
Yeah.
I thought that was like one of the greatest Coen Brothers movies, and everyone was sort of like, nah. And I'm like, no, watch it again. Watch it again.
I think sometimes when people are consistently great, and also they're consistently great in a different way every time.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. You got to watch them twice.
I feel like people don't always like appreciate it because they take it for granted or something.
Or they miss it. Like, you know, it took me years to really process The Big Lebowski.
Right.
And even like something like Burn After Reading, like I had to watch that twice, you know? And
Brad Pitt is so good in that movie.
So good.
He's so good in it.
When he really wants to act, I mean, he can really do it.
Yeah.
Like get into a character.
He's having a great time.
Oh, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
With his headphones.
Yeah. I rewatched all their movies before I went off to make it.
You are studious.
But I also like, that's fun.
I know. Of course like, it is. I'm not judging you.
No. What I'm saying is like, I did it because, yes, it's studious, but also like, when am I ever going to get to be in a Coen Brothers movie again?
Right.
So I might as well watch them all before I go do it so I can really take it in, like appreciate it.
And I do think that even though they're all different, there is a way that they sort of orchestrate things.
Yeah, well, yeah. This one's very tonally tricky. Like every chapter of it has a slightly different tone.
Uh-huh.
And so I think part of my feeling was like, I want to like watch a bunch of their movies so I can get a sense of like the range of tone. So sure. I can like figure out where I live.
Oh, great. And it worked. Paid off.
I guess.
I got to watch it. But you've done a lot of movies in small part. You like really kind of like slowly got more attention in movies.
Like, yeah, I guess so.
I guess that's the way it works, right?
I think so.
And like, I'm trying to remember, it's complicated. I know that I saw it, but you got some attention. Were you the daughter?
Yeah, I was one of the daughters.
Right,
in that.
Right.
Yeah.
And you sort of got a little attention for that movie? Was that the first time? Or when was the first time, really?
I did this. So my first like bigger part in a movie, I did a part in Revolutionary Road, the Sam Mendes movie.
Was that with...
Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet.
And was that the one with Michael Shannon?
Yeah.
I just saw him last night.
You did?
I saw him walking down the Sunset, and I was on the way to the Comedy Store, and I pulled over out my window. I'm like, Michael Shannon. He's like, what? It's Mark Maron. He's like, oh, what's up? Because he'd been on the show.
Yeah.
I'm going to do comedy. And then he came up.
Oh, that's
like,
nice.
I didn't even ask him. But
he's a nice guy.
He's intense. He's a very nice guy. He's kind of an amazing actor.
Yeah.
So, like, well, I'm trying to remember, what were you? You were a daughter in that?
No, I played his secretary that he has an affair with, DiCaprio.
Right.
And that was, like, a big part and, a big job, you know, a kind of Tony movie.
Yeah.
And I was scared shitless. I was so frightened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how was Leonardo?
Really kind to me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that's sweet.
Yeah. He was really kind to me. I was really, really green and really scared.
Uh-huh.
But again, I loved that part.
Yeah.
She's a kind of fool, you know, which is always fun to play. Like Shelley Winters in A Place in the Sun or something.
Oh,
like,
right.
Someone
right.
a little fragile. A little right.
And taking advantage
and
of.
Needy and.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit.
Doesn't know what they're getting into.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Richard Yates, who wrote the book, doesn't have a lot of compassion for her, I think, on the page. So I was like trying to bring a little compassion to her. So that was sort of like the first thing that let me, you know, get into more rooms and
right.
be seen for more different things. And then I don't know. I don't know what the next like turning point would be, but. I wrote a movie that Paul and I made together called Ruby Sparks, and that was that Dayton Ferris, who directed Little Miss Sunshine, that. And that was sort of like a new chapter for me.
In terms of being the writer and having that.
Stepping into a different, and also like taking charge of my career in a different way, uh-huh. like being like, I'm going to,
be a creator.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, it's a good move. And I think everyone that, you know, certainly a lot of people that listen to this show and the nerd comedy world in general, The Big Sick was a big movie.
Yeah.
For you. It was like, you know, that's like a starring role all the way through. And
yeah.
But you did a lot of independent movies, but there was a lot of juice around that movie.
Yeah, there was. It was different.
Yeah, it was different because it was so true. And, you know, I know Emily. I know Kamel, but I know Emily, you know.
Yeah.
And it was sort of interesting to see her fictionalized, but I thought you were great in
Thanks.
It. But you weren't Emily. You were you know, doing that part. But
I didn't try to do Emily.
Right? No, of course not.
But
did you have fun on that movie?
Yeah, I loved doing that.
Yeah,
it was really great. You know, you're right. I had done a lot of independent film, and like, you know, to be totally honest, a lot of I don't know. Like, you never know how they're going to turn out, right?
Like,
oh, of course. It's always a crapshoot.
Right.
You're always like taking a gamble, like. Sometimes they work out well, sometimes they work out less well, but they rarely like hit a vein the way that movie did. Like, like people saw that movie, Amazon got behind it, like critics loved it.
Yeah.
And that had never really happened to me before. Like I'd been involved in things that were successful, but it felt like, oh, it hit a little like zeitgeisty moment in a kind of way.
And I think independent films in general are all underdogs in a way.
Yeah.
That, you know, if one surfaces for whatever reason, it's usually like, we did it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but what I was going to say is, like, you can never tell on set, like, how something's going to go, right? Yeah. But we had a really good time making that movie. And like walking away from making it, I was like, oh, well, if this movie doesn't go anywhere, that was still really great. Like, I still had a really great time. Like, Showalter runs a set in a really great way. He's like really relaxed. He seems really happy about everything. Like,
yeah.
like a lot of positive reinforcement. He would say like, we can do it again if you want to, but I thought that was pretty great. And like something about the way that he said it would make me go like, let's move on. Whereas normally I'd be like, give me one more.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. That's a good experience.
Yeah, it was good.
So let's talk about this new movie, Paul Dano. You and Paul Dano made this movie.
Yeah, we did.
I watched it.
You did.
I liked it.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful looking movie.
It is.
And it's a nicely acted and written movie. My question after watching that movie, you know, in terms of, you know, how many movies are made and why people make movies, why'd you choose that material?
So Paul fell in love with it. Paul fell in love with the book, which is a book by Richard Ford called Wildlife.
Yeah.
And he brought it to me and was like, do you think that this would make a good movie? And I saw so much of him in it, and he had been looking for something to direct.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, let's option it. We'll hire a writer. And then he sort of like dreamt on it for a while and was like, I want to take a stab at writing it. And he wrote a draft and he gave it to me, and I thought it was really bad.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, made a lot of notes, and we got about 5 pages into the script of me giving him notes, and we'd been talking for like an hour.
Oof.
And we don't really fight often.
Yeah.
We were like fighting, and I was finally like, yo, I think this will be better for our relationship if you just like let me rewrite you, because it will be faster.
Yeah.
And I can show you what I mean rather than telling you.
Yeah.
And so I did. And then we just started like trading drafts back and forth. So it started really like with him, like his attraction to the material.
Right.
Which I think comes from like a really personal place. I think it speaks like to some personal experiences he's had.
Uh-huh.
And then for me, like it started as a puzzle for me. Like the book is really, I think the book is a challenge in terms of adaptation. It's really interior. Like there isn't a lot, you know, it's a lot of internal experience.
Yeah, because if you were actually to sort of tell the story of the movie, you'd be like, that's the movie?
Yeah.
So like there was a lot of, you know, in the direction and in the acting to create that, a bigger space and something that is that interior.
That's exactly right. And
uh-huh.
Like writing it was like trying to make room for that space. Like mm-hmm. Paul keeps saying, like the space between the lines is as important as the lines in this movie. And so it was like a puzzle for me, and that was really fun, and I'd never adapted anything before. But then as I worked on it, I started to feel like really compelled by the character of Jeanette, and that Carey Mulligan plays really felt like there but for the grace of God go I. Like she lives in a time where her choice is really conscribed. Like she doesn't have a lot of room to express herself or find out who she is. And so she starts making the only choices she can make.
Yeah.
And I was just like super, super compelled by that.
Well, yeah, I thought that was, you know, obviously the centerpiece of the kind of emotional flux of the movie
mm-hmm.
was her performance in that character.
Yeah.
So, like, I found, because, you know, you're moving through this thing, and the cast is great. Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yep.
And who's the kid? He was good.
His name is Ed Oxenbold.
I thought he was very good, because you could, he held his not his emotion, but, like, he was, he held a lot in. Like, he was sort of a blank slate that you were reading into. You didn't quite know. But, you felt there was a lot going on under there.
Yeah, we felt that he was the last kid we saw. And
yeah.
We just, like, totally fell in love with him. He's Australian, and he sent in a tape from Australia, and we just fell in love with him. And mostly for that, exactly that quality that you're talking about. Like, he's making a lot of choices. He's got a lot going on, but it's all under the surface.
Yeah, and Bill Camp is one of these guys that you now see everywhere.
Totally.
Like, it's weird, because I never knew who the fuck he was. Until, that HBO movie.
Yeah,
the
Night
series,
of.
Night of. Yeah, and I'm like, and now it's like, he's in everything.
I know. He's been in the New York theater scene for a long time and, like, is like a god of the New York theater scene.
So
and
you then, knew him.
Yeah. And Paul had done Love and Mercy with him.
Uh-huh.
He played Paul's dad in Love and Mercy.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
So, you know, when we started casting it, Paul was like, I really think Bill would be right for this. But you're right. He's, like, had one of these, like, you know, second act career.
Real character actor.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, it is sort of, I just thought the way it was written, like, it was very good.
Thanks.
You know, because there is that space in the dialogue. And especially for Carrie's part, you know, like when she starts to come unglued, you know, it's both moving and scary and completely sympathetic.
I'm glad you found it.
Because it's 1960 and you kind of realize the constraints. But like, you know, in Jake's character, like, I don't know, it was all so subtle, but yet like there's a turn at some point where you're like, this is, because you, in these kind of movies, like it, because of the space you guys captured, it's Montana, right?
Yeah.
And like, you know, he shot the shit out of Montana. I mean, it was like Terrence Malick stuff, right?
Oh, that's nice.
Like just the space looked great.
Diego Garcia is our DP and he's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. But you're kind of waiting for something major to happen and you realize that it's happening, but it's really an emotional thing.
Yeah.
You know, even, you know, when she drives him out there to look at that, you know, I don't think I'm spoiling anything, just to look at fire, you're like, what the fuck? You know,
like, yeah,
like is mommy nuts or is mommy just like that, having grown up born in 1963 and having a mother who had other aspirations, who did not get to realize herself in probably the way she wanted, that sort of hit this trigger where you realize, like, is she being selfish? Yeah, absolutely. But is it neglect of the kid on some level? I guess so. But that was just the time, man. And kids are a little more resilient than you think they are.
Yeah.
And then when, you know, whatever happens with Jake after, you know, it ends, it's disturbing, but it's not, nothing breaks.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're aiming for. The idea, like, that a family can break apart without people breaking.
Right. But you know, you're watching, you know, Carrie, and you're like, oh God.
Yeah.
But I have a problem with the way it's described on Wikipedia. Maybe you should.
What is it described as?
It says the plot. In 1960, a boy watches his parents' marriage fall apart after the three of them move to Montana and his mother falls in love with another man.
Yeah.
That is not.
That's not what happens.
No.
No. But the first paragraph of the book says something not dissimilar from that. And I wonder whether they're just lifting it from the book.
Well, I understand it as a plot line. The only problem with it is the falls in love part.
I agree.
And I thought that was kind of genius. Like, you guys did a lot, or Paul did, or I don't know how it was written, with the camera where, you know, you see the kid seeing something, but you don't know if you're going to see it.
Yeah.
That's you know, true. And you know, there was one point where you didn't, but you could make your own assumptions. And then there was another point where you did, and it was not quite as horrifying as it could be.
Mm, yeah.
You know, because you're like, oh boy, how what's that kid going to take in when he peers into the house?
Yeah, for
right?
sure.
And then it was just sort of like, no, okay.
Have you ever spent like extended time in an editing room?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
I really love it.
That's where it all happens. I
learned so much. So we like helped produce this movie. And we both took the year off to edit the film. So even though Paul's the director, I was there all the time. And I learned a fuck ton. And honestly, like, the writing process happened all over again, which it seemed impossible. We worked on this script for 3 years. It seemed impossible that there was that much work still to do. And there was.
Oh, yeah.
And that was one of the things of, like, how long do you hold on this thing? How long is too long? Like, it's a slow-paced movie, like, but like, is the pace too slow? And then also, like, building performance, like, obviously it's all of these like genius actors,
right?
But you're also like responsible for like crafting the storytelling of
it. Yeah, you're the people that when you do an independent movie and walk away from it going like, I don't know what that's going to do, you're the guys doing it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It made me be like, oh God, I should have been a film editor. It seems like the best job.
Yeah, because if you have the footage, you really have like a whole other world to it. You have a whole new thing to explore.
Yeah, it's like, you've written books. Like when you're writing prose, like suddenly there's no like template. Like, you know, when you're writing a play or a script, there's a template.
Right.
And it sort of felt like that, like, we could make anything.
Yeah, we don't have to. He doesn't have to do that.
Yeah.
We can take that part all together.
Completely. We can start it in a completely different way. There are infinite numbers of movies you can make out of this footage.
Well, I thought that the way you guys build it is pretty great, you know, like, because there's something about as beautiful as Montana is and the way that was all shot, There's a menace to the isolation, you know, that functions right alongside of the beauty.
You're saying all the right things.
That, you know, that the space that's there, just because of, like, you have these humans ruminating or living in the world within themselves.
Yeah.
And that, you know, when it comes out, you know, it, that you're sort of like, it's so sparse that you're like, oh, it matters so much, right?
Yeah.
But I thought it was great. And I, before I knew it was a book, you know, like yesterday my producer said, well, it was a book. And I'm like, I could not understand why they would just pull this story out of nowhere. It seems so bizarre that the two of them would sit down and write this. And he's like, it's a book. I'm like, oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, that would be bizarre if that was like the burning story that we had to tell.
Exactly. And I was like, okay, I get it now. And you guys decided pretty early on that you weren't going to act in it.
Yeah, immediately. We never, that was never on the table. Partially because, honestly, when we first started writing it, we were like 27, 28. Like,
yeah.
And we were just too young. And we were thinking about actors who were really more like the age of our parents, because we were still thinking of them as the parents, you know?
Yeah.
And by the time we were really going to make the movie, we were like, oh, like they're our age, basically, like these characters.
Yes, yeah, right.
I mean, you know, I think that there's something about the mystery of your parents, which speaks to everyone. Like,
that's true. That's true.
Everyone's parents are a mystery to them.
Yeah, a line that I quote a lot from Michael Clayton is when Sidney Pollack says, people are fucking incomprehensible.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I really, well, we've had some like critical response, like even critics have been very kind to this film.
Yeah.
And even within that context, we've had reviews where it said, oh, this unsympathetic woman, unsympathetic character. And I feel like you're lying to yourself about how people are if you think that good people don't behave this way. Like, people go through shit. Like,
especially that generation. They were young. They were kids.
Completely. I think about it all the time. My grandmother was 21 when she had her first kid.
My mom was 22.
If I had had a child at 21, that child would be so messed up right now. Like,
my mother's barely together now.
Yeah. Well, and also like the alcoholism and there's like a whole thing in that generation.
But you didn't overplay that either.
No. Well, that would have colored the story.
It was weird when, you know, there was a couple of like amazing choices like in that scene. I don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, when Jake's character does what he does in anger, that, you know, and Bill Camp's character, that the fact that he was with the woman who worked at the place, it was like, oh, this is just men.
I'm so glad you picked up on that. Well, you know, we don't have a close-up shot of her.
Yeah.
You know, she's in a wide, and it was like a little detail where we went like, well, I guess we'll see whether people pick up on this or not.
Could have been any woman. I mean, you have the moment where you're like, oh, is he married? And then you're like, no, that's the fucking,
another woman.
Just
Yeah.
So that guy's just that guy.
Bill Camp said this wonderful thing in a Q&A about that character. He plays this like really like loche character, and who's been through the war, and he's got like a limp, and someone asked him about like, what's this guy's motivation? And he was like, he's been in a lot of pain for a really long time, and he wants to have pleasure. Like, he's just seeking pleasure. And I was like, oh, damn, it's so good. It's true. And it's like, I never would have thought of it. And it's right there on the page. It's not like it's a good example of character backstory.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't invent that. It's right there.
But that's the core of it. That's sort of, as an actor, like, what is it, the word I want? The motivation.
Yeah, totally.
You know, that's the core of it.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It was really fun. You know, we've acted together a bunch of times, Paul and I. We met doing a play together, and we did this movie called Meek's Cut Off together. We did the movie that I wrote together. And it was really hard acting together, and I don't think we'll do it again. But writing together was really nice.
Well, good. You did a great job.
Thanks.
Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
The movie is Wildlife. That was Zoe Kazan. She co-wrote it with Paul Dano, and it's playing in select theaters now. All right, dig it. Boomer lives!